Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
This country is at war with Germany.
We shall go on to the end.
I remember the sheets of flame which came up and almost blinded us from our guns.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. So in this episode, we're going to be discussing one of the most remarkable soldiers of the British Army, Adrian Carton de Wyatt. Belgian by birth, he would fight in the Boer War, lose an eye in the Somaliland campaign, win the Victoria Cross and lose a hand in the First World War, command the British troops during the Norwegian campaign in 1940, spent time as a prisoner of war for the Italians, where he escaped, and finished the war as Winston Churchill's personal representative to Chiang Kai-shek. The Oxford Dictionary of National Biography describes him thus: with his black eye patch and empty sleeve, Carton de Wyatt looked more like an elegant pirate and became a figure of legend. I'm joined by Alan Ogden, author of The Life and Times of Lieutenant General Sir Adrian Carton de Wyatt, Soldier and Diplomat. But before we get started, I'd just like to take a moment to thank those of you who support the podcast. Those small contributions each month do help me put the time aside to produce the show. Now, if you've not already done so, head over to patreon.com/ww2podcast. Patreon allows listeners of the show to sign up and give me a dollar or two or whatever they want each month. For those that are patrons, I do try to give something back in the shape of extras, bits of podcast that might be left on the cutting room floor. So for the price of a posh cup of coffee, why not help me keep the show on the air by going to patreon.com/ww2podcast. Alan, thanks for joining me. So Carton de Wyatt, he is the most remarkable man and also can claim to be one of the most wounded officers in the British Army, having been wounded a grand total of 11 times, twice in the Boer War, once in Somaliland and 8 times in the Western Front. But he wasn't British. What are his origins?
Well, he was Belgian. The Carton de Wyatt family were an old Belgian family. They were first recorded in the early 18th century and they lived in a part of Belgium which is now in northern France. Of wedding, and his father, Leon, was a young lawyer in Brussels. So he was Belgian through and through, although there was an Irish grandmother on one side of the family. And the de Wyatts were a well-known family. I mean, his father's cousins provided a chef de cabinet for Leopold II, a grand marshal for King Baudouin, and then the other cousin was a minister of justice and then became the prime minister after the First World War. So they were a distinguished Belgian family, although there was a connection with England in the sense that his father had been educated at Stonyhurst. So there was an Anglophile side to the family.
It's that strange sort of European upper-classness that they're almost without borders, aren't they? Where they all sort of know each other. But he himself gets sent to England to be educated, doesn't he?
Oh, yes. I mean, he was sent to the Oratory School. And then the Balliol College in Oxford. So he had the classic English education. Yes.
And so how does he get into the British Army? Because I wasn't quite sure if we took foreign recruits into the British Army, even though he's sort of an aligned country. For the Boer War, I guess we're talking about, aren't we, when the Boer War breaks out?
Well, he was at Balliol at the time as an undergraduate. And then when the Boer War broke out, when the Boers crossed the frontier in Natal in October, 1899, he decided to enlist. And I think it's important that the background was one of extraordinary jingoism. There was lines of people besieging the recruiting offices, waiting to join up. And so he just passed himself off as British He was underage, by the way, gave a false name in the sort of pandemonium of the recruiting office, and emerged as Trooper 13010, Trooper Carton, as a member of Paget's Horse in the Imperial Yeomanry, and headed off for South Africa.
And presumably, if he's recruiting, he's volunteering from Oxford, they'll be aware of his public school background, and presumably he'll have, my assumption is he has a very upper-class British accent being educated here. So does he get fingered for officer training? Do they?
No.
I don't know, quite. Officer training might not be what they did at the time.
No, well, I think Paget's Horse was a volunteer force started by this man called George Paget. They abbreviated as PH, which in London circles was known as either the Piccadilly Hero or even more derogatory, perfectly harmless. They all departed for South Africa. So it was a sort of scratch force. It was not part of the regular British Army at all. It was a sort of a group of volunteers. Some had served in the army, some hadn't, some had just joined up. Really, nobody questioned what this young man, Carton Dwight, who was a trooper, nobody really questioned about it at all. And off they all sailed.
So how much active service did he see within the Boer War?
Well, the answer is not a lot on this particular occasion. I think he was shot fairly early on,
right?
First in the stomach and then in the groin. And later, when asked how many Boers were involved in the action, he said, not many, but the few there were very good shots. And it was at that moment, when he was hospitalised, that his identity was rumbled, and he was sent off, packed off back to England. And there was a meeting with his father, Leon, who was pretty upset that having sent him off to Balliol, he then disappeared to South Africa and come back wounded. But they made it up. He then agreed to go back to the Balliol.
Does get back into the army yet again, though, doesn't he? He sees action again in South Africa, doesn't he?
Well, he did go again. After a period, his father agreed that he could then actually become a soldier, because that, he said, is all I ever wanted to do. And he'd been away for a year from South Africa, so he then headed back out as a trooper, again as a trooper, in the Imperial Light Horse, which is another one of these sort of outfits, which was composed of all different people, really, from around the Commonwealth, around the UK. Again, nothing to do with the regular British Army. And it was then that he was spotted, if you like, by somebody who later became a general, Colonel Charles Briggs, who arranged for him to receive a commission. And he got a commission in the 4th Royal Irish Dragoon Guards. So that was his first, I suppose, official position with the British Regular Army.
Presumably then he can then transfer into the Dragoons to remain in the army after the war. So how does he get on with peacetime soldiering?
Well, they went off to India, which he didn't really enjoy. He quite good at pig sticking. They were then sent back to South Africa, and he got a sort of staff job there, working as an ADC, which he quite enjoyed, and it also brought him into contact with this fascinating group of young men who were working for Milner. And they included people like John Buchan, for instance, Philip Carr, Geoffrey Dawson, the future editor of the Times. So he was sitting really in the sort of middle of this rather sort of glamorous group of young men. Now, as the ADC to General Sir Henry Hilliard. No action was going on at all. They were reconstructing, if you like, South Africa. After that, he came back. By this time, the 4th Royal Dragoon Guards were in Brighton. He then went on leave to Cairo to see his father, Leon, who lived there, and his stepmother. And it was there that he met a German princess called Ricky Fugger von Babenhaus. And she fell madly in love with him. And they got married. And he's now a married man, if you like, in an army quarter in Brighton. He then manages to get a job as the adjutant of the Royal Gloucester Hussars, and they move to the Cirencester area. There's no real soldiering going on. It's just sort of, it's jolly nice life. Plenty of hunting, plenty of chasing, plenty of shooting, but no soldiering.
Now, in a world which must have been full of soldiering, it is presumably, as you say, a lot of lots of hunting, very evil in war sort of country house living.
Yes, I did. Well, there wasn't actually a lot of soldiering going on in that particular moment, up until the beginning of the First World War. One of the few places there was a sort of war going on, or a sort of more of a bush war than anything else, was in Somaliland, where the British government were trying to get to grips with a gentleman called the Mad Bullet, who did not agree with the policy of the British in that part of the world. That had been rumbling away for a long time. And then Gondwat decided that he'd had enough of this peacetime soldiering, and he decided, well, I'm going to head off to Somalia. And he left England in July 1914. And, of course, a month later, he had got by that. I'd say he was in Somalia fighting the Mad Bullet.
He seconded to the Somaliland Camel Corps, which sounds just the most fantastic operation. I wonder if you've got to ride camels, these sort of proto-Lawrence of Arabia.
It was sort of very romantic sort of soldiering, I suppose. You know, it's the sort of thing that the British young officers really enjoy. And it was here that he got shot again. He was part of an action of attacking a fort. Or maybe a tower is a better description, a high stone tower. And the chap in front of him was shot dead, and he followed up. And the next moment, he was hit in the eye. So back he came to England.
He gets a DSO for that action, Distinguished Service Order, doesn't he?
He did.
In Somalia,
yes,
for
yes,
carrying
yes.
out that attack.
He then goes into the hospital, and his eye is removed. And so he goes to the Army Medical and says, I need to be past fit because I'm going to join my regiment in France. And they said, well, our terms are this. You've got to have a glass eye. He presented himself to the Army Medical Board at Millbank Hospital. They said, well, it fits. I said, well, keep our side of the deal and we'll pass you fit. They walked out of the hospital, climbed into a taxi and threw the eyeball out of the window. And he covered the eye socket with a black patch. You know, he was to live with the rest of his life. And it gave him that slightly piratical look, which I think he enjoyed. He was now ready to take on the Kaiser's army.
It did, but he's not in France long before he gets his next major injury. I mean, he's quite remarkable. I mean, how he often gets hit.
He got wounded very soon afterwards. I mean, he rejoined his regiment in February 1915, and they were in the area of Ye. He then goes out on patrol, and there's a bit of a muddle because they're trying to get to a rendezvous, an army point, but nobody really knows what they're doing, and they walk straight into the jungle. There's a short engagement. He gets shot in the left hand, and pretty badly. And so back to England he goes, and this time the left arm comes off below the elbow. Later on, when he was asked what he thought of wound stripes which were issued in the First World War, I think he would have had probably none. He said, I don't see the point of them, really, because it's quite clear to anybody that I'd been wounded not once, but twice. I have an empty sleeve and a black patch.
Well, as you allude to there, it's not as if it stops him from going back. You know, he's now only got one eye. He's got a hand missing. It amused me to read later he enjoys shooting, so you know, game which must have been difficult with. He must have had quite an unusual way of doing it with only one hand. But he goes back to France. He's back as soon as 1916. So he loses his hand in 1915, and he gets his Victoria Cross. So what was that for?
It's interesting because he doesn't go back to his cavalry regiment, because what people are looking for, and particularly the Major General Tom Bridges, who knew him very well, was looking for talented officers, be they infantry officers or cavalry officers, to take command of infantry battalions. Those were what they wanted in the line. So he first of all got a job as second in command of the Loyal North Lancashire Regiment, and then he got, in fact, command of his own regiment, the 8th Battalion of the Gloucestershire Regiment. So, there he is for the first time, June 1916, and he is the commanding officer of an infantry battalion, which is remarkable in many ways, but that was really the story of his life. I mean, he was the most remarkable soldier. shortly afterwards, there was a big engagement in the area of La Boiselle, where he was awarded a Victoria Cross. It was an extraordinary action because there were three battalions involved in it. The commanding officers of the other two were both killed. So he ended up rallying the three battalions on the objective and holding the ground until they managed to reorganize. His citation read for the most conspicuous bravery, coolness, and determination during severe operations of a prolonged nature. He was owing in a great measure to his dauntless courage and inspiring example that a serious reverse was averted. He displayed the utmost energy and courage in forcing our attack home. After three other battalion commanders had all become casualties, he controlled their commands and ensured that the ground won was maintained at all costs. I mean, there is one image of literally throwing grenades over a wall with the Germans on the other side of the wall. That was his way of conducting the battle. I think it's a little bit of a strange story because one writer said he was pulling the pins out with his teeth, but you can't do that. Because the pin on a grenade has been split at the end to stop it coming out. And first of all, you've got to pinch the bring it out. Can't do that with your teeth. And since he only had one arm anyway, I can well see his Batman doing all the preparations for grenades and handing them up to him one after another. And he actually did the tray with his right arm.
Here you are, sir.
Another one, sir.
Well, you do. It does sort of, you know, he's now strolling around the battlefield with an arm missing, and, you know, as you say, his eye patch, presumably his revolver. He must have cut quite an impressive sight to three battalions with all their officers dead, and he's rallying them. These people must, what the hell have we got here?
Well, I mean, contemporary accounts just talk of him walking completely coolly through shell fire. Not with a revolver out necessarily, with his stick, completely cool. And of course, when something like that appears on, it just has an immediate effect on the morale of the soldiers, particularly the other officers, and then that will cascade down to their men.
I think I'm right. Said he's at the Somme, is it Passchendaele, is it Cambrai, is it Arras? He takes part in all these major actions. And gets shot in quite a few of them, as you alluded to, his nine wound stripes. It is a remarkable First World War he has.
Well, he's very lucky not to have lost his leg at one of them. He came out of the war, as Peter Fleming later described, as a grand blessé. But he ended up as a divisional commandant, which is quite a feather in his cap. And although, of course, he was only on an acting rank, so he wasn't going to go up the chain of command as a divisional commander, he would have to go back. I think he was actually only an acting colonel at the time. I mean, sorry, a substantive colonel, if that.
For such a fighting soldier, post-war, he's sent on the British Poland military mission. I mean, what is that? I mean, what are they doing? It seems sort of a, as I say, such a fighting soldier. He seems an odd position, perhaps, for him to be selected to do.
The military mission in those days was actually technically called the British delegation to the Inter-Allied Commission to Poland. So it wasn't a sort of a run of the normal British military missions. And it was there to represent the British, if you like, and there were Italians there, there were French there, there were Americans. And this was to make sure that the situation in Eastern Europe, particularly in Poland, was reported accurately back to Paris, where the Versailles Treaty was in the progress of being concluded. The original establishment for De Waard was, there was an acting brigadier general. He had one general staff officer, grade two, an attached officer, one clerk and two men. That was it. I think it's important at this stage that, because it does colour what happens in the future, that there was this English veneer to him after his career, education at the Oratory and Balliol and being an officer in a British cavalry regiment. But he was also a continental. He had the exquisite manners that somehow the British didn't have. And he was always, people talk about, there's always a sort of feminine streak to him because he had considerable emotional intelligence. And this, again, I think, was from his Pearl family background. He could understand how Europeans ticked much better than a run-of-the-mill British officer. This gave him a great advantage in working with the French and the Italians, but even more so with the Poles. And he became quite close to Pilsudski, who, Marshal Pilsudski, who was in the process of rebuilding Poland after the First World War, which it didn't exist. It was a complete vacuum. And there had been more left since about 1795, when the Grand Duchy of Warsaw really disappeared. And then the Duchy of Warsaw agreed at the Congress of Vienna. It was all very well, but the very fact that the Tsar was the Grand Duke effectively meant it was part of Russia.
What are they actually doing in Poland? Are they just literally gathering information and feeding it back to Britain and the ongoing... I mean, because the First World War for Poland doesn't just end in, you know, November 1918. You have this war of independence with all the peoples in and around it, really.
Military intelligence at that particular moment was actually political intelligence, because they were witnessing, if you like, all the fighting that was going on in the north, the fighting that was going on in the Ukraine. And this is what was determining the outcome, if you like. Whatever the political plans they were hatching up in Paris, they were in a way meaningless compared to the reality of what was going on the ground. I would say that at that particular moment, military intelligence in that part of the world was political. They were feeding that back into Paris.
Yeah, and it's, for some respects, it's interesting, because he goes on to the end of the Boer War. You could almost loop this back to his experience at the end of the Boer War. He's part of the reconstruction. It's all, again, that's it's more of a diplomatic role as a soldier than necessarily a soldiering role. There's two threads to his soldiering career, I guess, goes back all the way to the Boer War. So when the mission's wound down, he decides to leave the army, which is, considering how much of a man of action he appears to be, strikes me as a surprising thing for him to do. So what does a derring do soldier fill his time with before the next war?
The inter-allied mission was run down in sort of March, April 1919, because it completed its job reporting back to Paris. But then there was another. It was sort of resurrected as a British military mission this time. It was really to keep the military in this country informed as to what was going on in Poland, which was still in a state of complete flux. And actually, that's where he really got into his stride, because by this time he had established excellent relationships with the Poles. And so his reports, I think, were extremely valuable in shaping policy in London. Although, of course, a lot of them were ignored, as Lloyd George had a very different view about the Poles. But then, I think, again, it's important to that this whole area of Poland after the First World War was under really control of the French. And they had 1,500 seconded soldiers with the Polish army, which is a considerable amount. The British had something like 10. So there was very little political will to get involved in Poland back in London. And of course, Churchill had been conducting this campaign against the Red Army, which had ended up as a disaster. And all the other various expeditions up in the Baltic states, they'd also come back. But the Wyatt and his small team hung on in there. And they were the ones who witnessed this extraordinary campaign by Pilsudski after the Russians attacked Poland in major force, as he drove them out. And of course, the extraordinary thing is the line that they were all chatting about in London, the so-called Red Line, which was where border was meant to be. By the time Pilsudski had finished, Poland bordered on Russia, and it included all of today's Belarus. This extraordinary story of this country that had just come from nowhere and in 4 years had established itself over a vast territory in the east. And Novart had been very close to the whole of this, what he described as the birth of a nation.
So why did he leave the army at the end of end of this period when the mission's wound down?
Well, the answer is that he was hoping to get a brigade in England, but there wasn't one. And he was offered a cavalry brigade in India, but he didn't like it. He just said, okay, that's enough. And I think he was allowed to retire as a temporary major general. He was only a substantive colonel, actually. But he transferred to the regular army reserve of officers as an honorary major general. And that was the end of his career with the British Army.
Which is quite remarkable for, you know, someone with Victoria Cross, Distinguished First World War, and then he sort of slips into... It's interesting in the book because you point out that we don't know almost nothing about him for the next 16 years. He just sort of slips from view, living in Poland.
I called him, my biography of him, the missing years. And he does go into almost self-exile into the eastern borderlands of Poland. And that is through a friend of his, Prince Radziwill, who he got to know very well when he was working in Warsaw. The prince offered him a house on his estate at a place called Stolin and said, you can come and live here. The shooting of that part of the world is amazing. It's really in the Pripyat Marsh. So, you know, anybody who likes shooting duck or varieties of duck, he was in heaven. But there's a sadder story to that because the marriage with Ricky and their two daughters hadn't survived the war. And so she remained in England. And I think that the word that probably describes a relationship was that they were estranged, but we made question of divorce in those days. There was something in him that made it very hard to continue with this sort of, if you like, a life of domesticity. And of course, he'd been away throughout the First World War, and then he'd been in Poland. So he hadn't been home, except various short leaves, really, for something like 9 years. And in that time, the marriage had, from his point of view, not his responsibilities, but I think that's the idea of having, getting back to domestic life, he couldn't get his head around.
Folks, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back with you in a moment.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Welcome back. I'm talking the life and times of Adrian Carton de Wyatt with Alan Ogden. I don't know how long you remain on the military reserve list of officers, but I can't imagine that he would still be on it, surely, by when war was looming in 1939. So how does he get recalled to active service for the British government?
He kept in touch because every winter he would come back from Poland and rent a flat at St. James, and then he would socialise with his old army chums. So from that point of view, he'd kept his hand. He then, at the beginning, just in early 1939, he'd written to Lord Gort, who was the chief of the Imperial General Staff at the time, and said, I'm keen to do my bit. Are there any jobs yet? And Gort said, no, there is. He took that rather badly. But then General Ironside appeared in Poland as part of a senior visit, and they had dinner together in Warsaw. And soon afterwards, the director of Military Intelligence, Bernard Nesbitt, said to the Wyatt, would you like to take on the British military mission to the Poles? And he knew Bernard Nesbitt because he had bumped into him in Poland when he was there after the war, and also he'd come up to stay with him in Stalin. So they were good friends. And he was the director of military intelligence. So that's really, I suppose you could say, that he got back in on the old boy network. But then what better man to lead the British military mission, who knew the entire Polish general staff, he knew the politicians. I mean, it was a slam dunk casting, I suppose.
Well, presumably after living there for so long, he could speak the language, as you say, he's straight in. So that military mission can't have lasted, he can't have had the job for very long. And presumably they retreat out of Poland as it collapses.
It didn't last very long. I think 2 days after he arrived in Warsaw, the Germans invaded. The remainder of the mission was all coming out from London, headed by Colonel Gubbins, as it was in those days, who then became famous as the head of SAE during the rest of the war. They then had a very difficult route in. Now I think they had to go to Athens, and then they've got an aeroplane to southern Poland, and they all turned up finally together in Warsaw about 2 weeks after the Germans had attacked. So after that, it was just, if you like, an orderly retreat down to the Romanian border. But they did bring out most of the British embassy, which was quite an achievement. And it was pretty stressful. I mean, the German bombing was fairly random. One of the wives of the embassy staff was killed in a bombing raid. Anyway, they all got out of it, went back safely. And so he arrives back in England. Gubbins puts together a very good paper about the German blitzkrieg tactic. And one does wonder whether anybody read it. It would be very helpful. And he is then given the 51st Division in Oxfordshire, which is a territorial division, with a lot of untrained reservists and hardly any equipment. That's his first job back home.
But it's a big leap from that to being put on the active service to be commanding troops in Norway in 1940. Because he can't have commanded troops since the end of the first, in any numbers, since the end of the First World War. It struck me as being slightly odd, and I know he's not a Colonel Blimp figure, but it's almost Colonel Blimp-esque choosing a hero from the First World War to send to Norway, which makes me wonder why he's chosen and how does he perform in Norway.
But the whole reaction to the invasion of Norway was frankly pretty chaotic, and they put these scratch force together. One was called Morris Force, which was to sort of composite group of French and British brigades to land at Namsos, and the other was Sickle Force, which was to land further to the south. And the idea was they would then both join up and take control of the Trondheim area, including the town and the airfield and the fields around Trondheim. And they were desperately looking for some people to head it up. I mean, who was available? I think we were very much on the back foot then. I mean, we had the BEF sitting in France. Then the Norwegian campaign happened. And quite a lot of the army was in North Africa fighting the Italians. So there wasn't a great pool of us. And so Arnside, who liked the Wyatt, I think appointed him. And so off he went. His performance, I think, was remarkable, because the whole premise of the expedition, if you like, was for the Navy to move in to the fields around Trondheim and take control of the sea lanes there. Well, they didn't. So you had two infantry formations landed and then started to try and join up, but without any air cover and without any naval fire support. It was never going to work. It was as simple as that. And I think the Wyatt, because of his experience and his level-headedness, he certainly wasn't a romantic. Just kept the whole thing on the road, say, for as long as he possibly could, and then organised, I think, an impressive withdrawal and managed to get virtually everybody off at Namsos, safely back to England.
Obviously, considering it's a failure, he actually doesn't come out of it too badly. As you say, I think it's a bit of a poison chalice when he took the job.
He wasn't really worried about his reputation. I think that's one of the attractive sides of him. I mean, he never, ever tried to pin it on anybody else. He just got on with it. He did brief Admiral Keyes about it, but I think he only pointed out, really, that if you launch a landing from the sea, you have to be incredibly well organized. You've got to take into account that you're going to need anti-aircraft defenses, you're going to need supply. And of course, what happened was, and there's a slight irony here, was that the person who really ran the campaign was Churchill, as First Lord of the Admiralty, and it was Churchill's decision to suddenly switch some of the forces heading towards Zamsos up to Narvi. That completely got in the way of all the supply ships coming behind. And so they started sailing off in different directions, and the supply ships turned up in the wrong ports with the wrong gear.
And even Churchill gets away with it in many respects. He admits to the problems, and then Chamberlain gets the blame.
Well, he does. He was honest about it. Yeah, right. He did. And then, of course, after that, he became prime minister.
He's next. Now, Dwight's next posting is the military mission to Yugoslavia. Now, this doesn't quite go according to plan, does it?
But it doesn't get there. The aircraft taking him there had engine failure and crashed in the Mediterranean. And they all ended up on Italian-occupied soil in Libya. They were then put in a prisoner of war camp on the mainland, where he spent quite a lot of time. Did he enjoy it? I don't think any of them particularly enjoyed it. They were curious. They were all very senior officers being captured one way or another.
It's a remarkable selection of officers he's imprisoned with Gambier Perry and Richard O'Connor. And who's the other one?
Absolutely. He got on very well with Dick O'Connor. He kept very fit because he was a terrific fitness fanatic.
He's 60 at this point. Oh, we might even be older than that. Is he 60 or is he 61 at this point?
He's more than 60. And of course, the extraordinary thing is they then dig a tunnel. And out they go, and he is paired up with Dick O'Connor. And they managed to walk. Heading up towards Switzerland, they managed to walk about 120 miles before they're finally rumbled by a Carabinieri patrol. I mean, people of that rank and of that age to escape was really amazing.
Well, the other thing is, he's not exactly inconspicuous. We're looking for a man with one arm and an eye patch. He has a limited ability to blend into the to people around him.
And one of the languages he didn't speak was Italian. Although, funnily enough, Dick O'Connor's Italian was pretty good because he had fought in the 1917-1918 campaign up in Northeast Italy. But the interesting thing was, they were dispatched back to a prisoner of war camp and given a 1 month solitary confinement, which I shouldn't think worried him at all. But then what happened was that this is a time when the peace feelers was being established with the Italians, and he was asked by the Italians whether he would come down and accompany one of their senior generals who go to Lisbon, because they hadn't heard from the Italian team that had been sent their own. So there was a bit of a panic going on. So he did. He was then offered the opportunity to be repatriated, which he accepted. And he finds himself back in England. And this is where it's quite interesting, because Churchill was a tremendous fan of Cardinal de Wart.
Did they have a relationship that went all the way back to the Boer War? I wasn't quite sure where their lives intersected.
They did. I don't think it went back to the Boer War. I think it certainly went back to Versailles and Poland and Norway, of course. But more than that, Karl de Wart is probably one of the most famous men in the British Army. You know, in the tremendous amount of PR in the newspapers about him in the First World War, everybody had heard the name. And he, of course, when he'd been in Paris, he'd been painted by William Orpen. And then, interestingly enough, when he got back from Norway, he was painted by Lady Londonderry, and her picture then appeared in the summer exhibition at the Royal Academy in 1940. And it was the most viewed portrait in the whole exhibition. Everybody knew him. Churchill held him in great esteem. I mean, Churchill was actually quite a romantic, as we know. And so this sort of elegant part, Churchill thought, well, I'd say that's when he asked him to be his personal representative to try and catch it.
You know, I wondered if that was playing to Chang's vanity. You send a very famous British soldier, Victoria Cross winner, seen active service in both world wars.
I mean, Cardinal de Wart said in his own autobiography, "China had never figured in my book of records. I imagined it a long way off, full of whimsical little people with quaint customs who carved lovely little jade ornaments and worship their grandmothers." I mean, that was a classic example of the sort of self-deprecation that he was paying for. And of course, he gets to China, and the first thing he has to come to terms with is that the British have hardly got a voice, and it's the Americans who are
basically in charge of everything, including Vinegar Joe Stoll.
Yes, who doesn't seem to get on with anybody.
No, he didn't, let alone his own fellow officers in the American army.
Did he make a big difference to Sino-British relations?
Again,
did he manage to woo Chiang Kai-shek?
I think he was always quite a ladies man, in the sense that women found him very attractive. And sadly, as a young man, he'd be marked. Look, here we've got to look at the story of how dear Ricky Pogobob Babelhausen, aged 19, got one look at him. Fell madly in love with him. As I referred earlier, you know, he had these beautiful manners, charm. And so suddenly, Madame Chiang Kai-shek warmed him. And it's about establishing these personal relationships that you really manage to build trust. Well, enough, Chiang Kai-shek didn't speak in it, but she did. But he managed to build up trust with the top Chinese leadership and also with the British ambassador, because his name got cross purposes. And so I think from that point of view, he was very effective. Mountbatten was a different kettle of fish. Mountbatten was absolutely focused on Burma. He had a tendency not to see the bigger picture in China. And when the Japanese attack came in 1944 and required the release of some American divisions in Burma to go up and bolster the KMT forces, Mountbatten sort of put his foot down and tried to block it. And that's when Garden of Iron, I think, was particularly effective, and he was able to get a message to Churchill saying, you know, look, this is the situation, and these forces don't come up, you know, there will be nothing left here at all. I think providentially the Japanese had run out of steam and extended their lines of communication. It was a sort of a pretty crucial position he occupied, in where he was able to influence these decisions.
As you say, he found disheartening, or I don't know if disheartening is possibly the way to describe it, but he struggled to figure out what difference he could make, because there was not necessarily the local backing. He suggests Wavell, doesn't he? He might be better in being replaced, which struck me slightly out of character.
I mean, he was there, really, a long time. And there were moments when I think he felt pretty lonely. Yes, you're quite right. There was a moment when he just said, I really don't know what I'm doing. But I think that was a blip, really, because I think he dropped his guard there almost for the first time. And I suspect the reason was because he had nobody he could really talk to.
So after the war, due to his age, he must have finally had to leave the army. What did he do after the war, after the army's finally spent with him?
Well, he arrived back with a broken back. Because he'd been staying I think it was Bangkok with the military attaché, managed to fall down the stairs. And so he was finally discharged from hospital and the army in June 1947. It was there that he managed to, I suppose, find love again with a lady called Joan Southern, who was at the divorcee, who, funnily enough, it had been married to somebody that Carl de Wart knew, and who would come to stay with him in Poland in the interwar years. But I don't think he'd ever met her. She took him under her wing and sort of nursed him back to strength after this broken back, also encouraged him to write his autobiography, which was a terrific success. And after Ricky died, finally in Vienna in 1949, they were able to get married, and they decided to move to Ireland. And that's where they set up their home. It was in part of Ireland in Cork, which one area had an uncanny resemblance to the ones of the Pripet Margins.
You mentioned his autobiography. He doesn't write about his Victoria Cross in his autobiography, does he?
No.
It's just bizarre.
Well, he didn't mention he was married and had two children either.
It was just a remarkable thing to miss out, considering, you know, in many people's eyes, it might be one of the greatest achievements of their life to win the Victoria Cross, but, you know, to not mention it.
Well, the publishers managed to turn that into a plus. Some of the copy on the cover jacket that says, you know, this amazing man is too modest to attend the Victoria Cross. It was a full life and a unique life, really. I mean, there'd be one-eyed British generals with one arm before. But I don't think there's ever been a Belgian who was a British general with one arm. And also, I think when I concluded the biography, I realized that I wasn't just writing about a soldier, but I was writing about a fairly accomplished diplomat who had this ability to strike up a personal relationship and really gain the trust of foreign leaders. That's extraordinary. I mean, Pilsudski was the marshal and the head of the Polish state. Tchaikovsky was the generalissimo, was the top man in China. And these were the people who felt able to confide in him.
I think, actually, the oddity is he's known for being shot. And actually, his success is as a military diplomat. But oddly, because of his personal courage, he manages to get himself shot so often that overshadows his success with diplomacy.
Peter Fleming, who he got to know very well in Norway because he was one of his staff officers. He only had two staff officers, Alfred Morris, of course, Peter and Martin Lindsay. And then, of course, Peter went to India to start D Division, which was the deception operations against the Japanese. So they had a lot to do with each other. And I'd just like to read from the obituary that Peter Fleming wrote. It was to the age of chivalry that Adrian de Wyatt properly belonged. He saw life as a list in which honour, when nothing much was happening, and duty, when his country was in peril, engaged him automatically as a contestant. It was once said of him that in the world of action, he occupied the same sort of niche that Sir Max Beerbohm occupied in the world of letters. And this was true, for he was, in all things, a stylist. De Wyatt's appearance was distinguished, thanks partly to a black eye patch and one empty sleeve, faintly piratical. He could be fierce and was intolerant of fools. But his mind had always feminine perceptiveness, and he was unfailingly considerate to others. He accepted, with an air of quizzical insouciance, every challenge that life offered. He might not have agreed, for he disliked empty or pretentious language, that danger has bright eyes. But he found them irresistible. Wonderful piece of writing.
It is a wonderful piece of writing. And the other thing that amused me about him, he considered himself to be born lucky, which in some respects, you go, well, yes. And in other respects, he got shot a hell of a lot for someone who was born lucky.
Born lucky.
Because it is a remarkable life of a time that's sort of passed, hasn't it?
Well, it was almost a sort of 18th century life. I mean, I feel he would have been at home in Marlborough's army. Kate Marlborough, there was a soldier diplomat. Those were the days when the Foreign Office didn't exist. And who was sent to the Vienna to deal with the Habsburgs but Marlborough?
Well, before we move on to Marlborough, we should perhaps leave it there. Thank you, Alan. I've been waiting for a good biography on De Wyatt for years. And as I said before we started, I was thrilled when I notice yours have been released. It really is excellent. Loyal listener, if you want to read about the career of one of the most amazing men in the British Army, Alan's book is The Life and Times of Lieutenant General Sir Adrian Carton de Wyatt, Soldier and Diplomat. And don't forget, if you have enjoyed the podcast and would like to help support the show, you can find me on Patreon, patreon.com/WW2podcast. So in the next episode, we'll be either in Tokyo, looking at the diplomatic machinations leading up to the war, or in the deserts of North Africa, talking about armoured warfare. See. So until then, I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
Very 88mm gun hit our tongue and blew us the hell out of it.
Stalingrad can never be repaired.
As Allied Commander-in-Chief, I have granted a military armistice.